Welcome to lesson number 4 in our series on contextual psychology. I'm Dr. Richard Nongard with Peachtree Professional Education. And in lesson number 4, I'm going to focus specifically on some of the major tenets of ACT therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy. This has been developed in large part by Dr. Stephen Hayes, a researcher at the University of Nevada, and is considered an evidence-based treatment protocol. Now, the first question I have, though, is, did you practice the mindfulness exercise using the YouTube link that I provided in the previous handout? I hope that you have had a chance to do that, because when you do that each and every day for the next 7 days, you're going to find that intuitively you become a more mindful person, and you'll know from firsthand experience what the value of mindfulness really is, not only to you, but to your clients as well. And so I want to encourage you to continue to do so, practicing with intention the ability to cultivate mindfulness on a day-to-day basis. Now, most of the material in this course really comes not from a theoretical perspective, but from an evidentiary-based perspective. The ideas in this course are based on what is called evidence-based treatment protocols. What is evidence-based treatment protocols? Well, it's an approach to questioning that leads to scientific experiment. It says, is this really how the mind works? Well, let's test it and find out. For example, a lot of people believed in the past that memory was kind of like a video recorder. Our eyes took a picture of the environment around us, and really at any time we could retrieve that information. In fact, I think a lot of the idea of regression to cause or Freudian analysis really was based on this theory of memory, and that we store all of this stuff on the sort of the hard drive of our subconscious mind, and later at any point we can retrieve it later on. Well, that theory was put to the test in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and really with research continuing to this day at the University of Washington, Elizabeth Loftus tested that theory and discovered that memory is really a lot more like a Wikipedia page. The information is put there, but anybody or anything can come along and change it, and that what the mind can't recall, somebody else is going to create. We'll create it with our creative mind, and the memory really isn't nearly as reliable as we thought that it was. That knowledge has come to us and is particularly valuable for those doing any type of work in criminal justice settings, because it's based on the evidence of psychology. And so evidence-based treatments are really a questioning approach that leads to scientific experimentation, which is why the methods in this course have research to back up their efficacy. I have not spent, and I'm not going to spend because of our time limitations, a large amount of time simply listing out the research, the journal articles, and those sorts of things. You can do that on your own time, and scholar.google.com is a great resource to help you. Evidence-based treatments are really the observation and recording of information and data about how the mind works versus really what was, for the most part, the predominant mode of publishing in psychological journals for really the first 70 or 80 years of the psychology profession, and that was anecdotal case presentations. Evidence-based treatment, then, is recording and cataloging of that evidence. So what we can do is we can go to the journals, we can go to our databases of psychological data, and we can say, hey, what works best with those who have, for example, social anxiety? And then we can look and discover, based on research, what is going to most likely be the successful approach to our clients. Well, why use evidence-based treatment protocols? First, it's encouraged by the recognized professional associations. It helps us as a profession to avoid the trap of quackery. And the idea of evidence-based treatment protocol is to actually produce meaningful results with clients. After all, that's why clients came to see us. They came to see us because they want to get better or experience change. And so in order for us to be able to help them accomplish that goal, we really do need to know what works. It is certainly the trend in public health, It is certainly the trend in the DSM-5, and we will see an even greater attention paid to the evidence-based treatment protocols for specific psychiatric disorders in future editions of the DSM. Evidence-based treatment protocols are, for the most part, required by third-party payers. They want to know now not only what our treatment plan is, but is there some demonstrated efficacy for the treatment protocols that we're using? And if the answer to that is yes, then we're probably going to get paid for the time that we spend with clients. If we can't document that the protocols or techniques we're using are beneficial to clients, then it's highly unlikely that we're going to be seeing much third-party reimbursement in the future. That is, by the way, one of the reasons why the certification component of this course can be valuable. It can be a way for you to demonstrate to third-party payers and others, hey, I have specific specialized training in evidence-based treatment protocols. And contextual psychology approaches are considered to be evidence-based treatment protocols. And of course, one of the other reasons why we pay attention to evidence-based treatment is so that ultimately we can select the best therapy for our client's condition. Different approaches work with different types of clients, and a one-size-fits-all approach really isn't healthy. And I think the final reason as to why we should focus on the evidence-based treatment protocols, things like ACT therapy, things like solution-focused brief therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, positive psychology, is so that we can move counseling into a serious discipline. The anecdotal must be replaced by that which actually has demonstrated efficacy with clients. Now, every now and then people say to me, well, if we, you know, learn evidence-based treatment protocol, isn't that really a one-size-fits-all approach? Here's the great thing about contextual psychology. It is very eclectic within the framework of empirically supported treatment. It is experimental in that new research and new theories are considered, but those are checked against our databases of empirical research. And the approach of contextual psychology is really forward-looking, rather than a proprietary system or an exclusive system or a system-oriented approach. There really are no gurus in contextual psychology. Certainly there are researchers whose research we might quote, but that doesn't make them a guru. In fact, I think Stephen Hayes in Acceptance and Commitment Therapy is the perfect example of a transformational leader in our profession. Why? Is it because he's gotten everything right? Absolutely not. At various points, his work has certainly faced a wide variety of challenges from an empirical perspective. Why Stephen Hayes is a great exemplar for transformational leadership is he hasn't said, this is about me. Instead, he has trained a cadre of leaders, a large number of graduates from his university, the University of Nevada, who are experts in taking this to the next level. It's always amazing to me whenever I see Stephen Hayes has published a new book, it is almost always a collaborative effort with other researchers in the field. There are usually three or four or five or six co-authors with him on almost all of his materials. And those folks who he has trained in evidence-based protocols are then developing new ideas and testing those. In evidence-based treatment, things are also not rigid. We have different levels of evidence. I encourage my clients not to be black and white in their thinking, believing I'm either depressed or I'm happy. All or nothing thinking. The same thing in our therapeutic approach. There are different levels of evidence for success. There are different levels for success. And there are actually different quantities of outcomes. There is no magic bullet that is 100% successful, which is why in this course on contextual psychology, we're talking about ACT therapy in this particular lesson. But we're going to be following that soon with some ideas from dialectical behavioral therapy, some ideas from mindfulness-based stress reduction, excellent ideas from Martin Seligman and positive psychology, as well as other approaches which have been empirically validated in a wide variety of clinical contexts. The approach of contextual psychology is educational. It is a coaching model to a large extent, and it is a training model where, as I said in previous lectures, Our role is really that of a teacher. The method of contextual psychology and ACT therapy is integrative. It is designed to be used in the context of our client's experience. And the ultimate goal, and this is why I love contextual psychology, ACT therapy in particular, the goal of contextual psychology is to help the client function apart from therapy. The goal of contextual psychology is not to have them keep coming back week after week, but to take what they've learned between the sessions, apply it, test it, find out what works most effectively for them in their unique context, and then ultimately to be able to function apart from having to go back to the therapist. This is why I love the model of brief therapy. And I was fortunate when I did my graduate school practicum, probably more than 28 years ago or whatever it was, I had a practicum supervisor who was part of the new field of solution-focused brief therapy at that particular time. It was a brand new idea. And being a marriage and family therapist, he didn't teach me to bring the couple back each and every week so they could continue to have a therapist in the middle of their marriage. He encouraged me to do 4 to 6 sessions with a couple and to evaluate in the 6th session a couple of different things. Have we accomplished our goal? No need to come back. Ultimately, that was the greatest indicator of success. Or have we accomplished our goal, but a new goal has emerged and maybe we'll meet for 4 to 6 more weeks? Always limiting the time, always evaluating the efficacy and the value of therapy and the client's ability to then put that into practice, or occasionally evaluating it in this context. Have at the end of 6 weeks, we not accomplished what was needed to, well, then it's either me, I don't know how to help you, and I should probably make a referral, or it's you, you've decided not to take advantage of the resources in the therapy session, in which case there's no need to come back to couples counseling. It's probably time to see the mediator next. And so the goal of contextual counseling is really to help the client function apart from therapy rather than to continue to fill billable hours week after week, year after year, with clients who are dependent on going back to the therapy process in order to function at an adequate level. Now, every time I say that, there's always somebody who says, but wait a minute, I work with, bipolar clients, I work with schizophrenic clients, I work with clients with, severe catastrophic mental illnesses. Correct. Those clients do exist, and they are on our caseloads. And there are some clients who we are going to be seeing on a long-term basis. There's one schizophrenic who I have worked with since 2006. I've worked with him now coming up on almost 10 years. And I see him on a regular, irregular basis, depending on what his level of functioning is, his adherence to the medications that are prescribed by the psychiatrist who I communicate with on a regular basis, etc. But my goal with this client is, again, not to have him come back each and every week. It's to help him function apart from the therapeutic process when he is able to function at his highest levels of performance, when he's compliant with his medication and doing the other things that he needs to do. And so with our catastrophically mentally ill clients, who may in fact need long-term care because of their unique needs, those options are available to us. But for most of my quote-unquote well but unhappy people who come to see me in outpatient counseling, my goal ultimately, and the way I know I'm a successful therapist, is if I get rid of them. ACT therapy, and by the way, Stephen Hayes has made clear that even though ACT therapy stands for acceptance and commitment therapy, he loves acronyms, and so there are a lot of acronyms in ACT therapy, and it is actually pronounced ACT therapy. And it differs from many other approaches to psychology in that his research into human emotions, which began by studying the whole problem of social anxiety, a very common psychological problem that can be debilitating for many people, is that the idea that the tools that we use to solve problems actually lead us further into traps that create suffering. This is where relational frame theory really fits into the picture. It's an evolutionary trait in psychological evolution that, well, means humans rule the planet rather than giraffes. But even though it's a useful tool, This same tool can actually lead us into further traps that create suffering. One of the basic premises of ACT therapy is that fighting pain actually just makes it worse. Now, that's counterintuitive. It really doesn't seem to be logical. But the research shows, from a psychological perspective, that fighting pain actually makes it worse. Probably one of the simplest explanations is that you have to direct your attention to that which you are fighting. For example, if I tell you right now, while you're listening to this MP3, do not listen or do not think of a yellow Jeep. No matter what you do as you're listening to this MP3, think about anything you want to other than a yellow Jeep. And right now, of course, I don't want you to think about a yellow Jeep. And so now I'm going to ask you, what are you thinking about? Of course, the answer is a yellow Jeep. The idea in ACT therapy is not to become undepressed or unanxious or even unangry, but rather to see our thoughts as just thoughts, our emotions as just emotions, and to help a client to detach from the relational frames that cause so much distress. The Association for Contextual Behavioral Science, which, by the way, is one of my favorite professional associations, I think their website is actually contextualpsychology.org, is one of my favorite professional associations because they have a values-based model. It costs $1 a year to join, and then professionals are encouraged to pay whatever the organization is worth to them. That's a pretty good model. Because I've joined a lot of different professional associations over the years, and some of them have certainly been worth far less to me than the dues that was paid. And so the organization is particularly responsive and particularly useful, I think, to members. Here's the definition of ACT therapy that the Association for Contextual Behavioral Sciences offers. ACT is an approach to psychological intervention defined in terms of certain theoretical processes, not a specific technology. In theoretical and process terms, we can define ACT as a psychological intervention based on modern behavioral psychology, including relational frame theory, that applies mindfulness and acceptance processes and commitment and behavior change processes to the creation of psychological flexibility. I've done a fair number of work with a recent colleague who is a military veteran. We've actually recently written a book, completed a book titled Counseling People Who Have Killed Other People. And my colleague's name is David Park. And David Park, in his work with military veterans, and as in a leadership position when he was serving in the military, talked about developing resiliency as one of the keys to mental health. This is part of psychological flexibility, an important aspect of ACT therapy that I think it makes it particularly useful for a wide variety of different types of clients that we work with. Now, I've included in the notes for this course an excellent summary of ACT therapy that can be found on Social Work Today's webpage. And they just have a great article that summarizes ACT therapy. If you're new to the subject, please check that link out because I think it's particularly useful. Stephen Hayes, in his book, Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life, which, by the way, is one of my favorite books. It certainly is part of the recommended reading for this course, Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life by Stephen Hayes. He points out 5 psychological truths that come from the research that really are counterintuitive to the way most of us would think about psychology and emotions. The first truth is that you cannot deliberately get rid of your psychological pain, but you can take steps to avoid artificially inflating it. Pain and suffering are 2 distinct states, and by inference, they do not need to coexist. You can have pain without suffering. I work with a lot of pain control clients, and that's one of the things from a physical perspective that really is hard for them to grasp, but I have to teach them that. And when they learn it, they find it tremendously freeing. This is true for our clients with emotional pain as well. One of the other truths outlined in his book, Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life by Stephen Hayes, is that you do not have to become your suffering. One of the most difficult of all the presenting problems in counseling is that our clients come in and they have in fact become their anxiety. They have become their anger. They've become their depression. They have become their failure. Hayes' research at the University of Nevada shows that paradoxically, accepting your pain is actually the first step into ridding yourself of suffering. And Hayes points out something else that really flies in the face of everyday thought, particularly because of the marketing of various pharmaceuticals and, you know, other self-help products. And that is that psychological pain is normal. It's actually normal to experience psychological pain. Hayes calls it important and tells us that everybody has psychological pain. I think our clients often come to us with the unrealistic expectation or belief that other people do not have depression, other people don't have anxiety, other people don't have these problems. And the reality is everyone has psychological pain. It is, in fact, normal. The key concepts in acceptance and commitment therapy are, of course, mindfulness, which I spent the entire previous lesson on, which is, of course, a way of observing our thoughts and being fully present in this moment. Mindfulness is one of the key ways to help us really separate pain from suffering and to help people take steps to avoid artificially inflating psychological pain. Acceptance is the notion that trying to get out of our pain only amplifies it. Trying to get out of your pain entangles you in it. That's what produces trauma. Paradoxically, the alternative here is acceptance. The paradox of quicksand is applicable here. Now, I have never actually been stuck in quicksand, but they say that if you find yourself in a pool of quicksand, your natural or your normal inclination would be to try to pull yourself out of it, to really swim your way out of it, to try to step out of it. But every time you step up, what you're doing is you're creating a hole of suction underneath that gets filled in, and you actually end up going deeper, eventually drowning in the quicksand. They say, who knew that the benefit of earning your CEU hours would be to learn how to extract yourself from quicksand? That the only way to actually get out of quicksand is to make yourself, it's counterintuitive, as still as possible. To essentially float yourself to the top and then to roll yourself out of the quicksand rather than fighting the quicksand. To go with the quicksand rather than to go against the quicksand. One of the interesting things is that in our profession, we have almost no training in modalities of helping clients to achieve acceptance. In fact, really one of the few things that I'm aware of in the field of psychology, and it's really not in the field of psychology, it's in the field of self-help on acceptance, comes from page 449 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I would imagine is probably one of the most famous sections or quotes from the Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book. It says, "And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I'm disturbed, it's because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity till I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it's supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. And till I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and my attitudes." Wow, that's from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Extremely profound. And I think a great quote or paragraph that summarizes the value of acceptance. Part of acceptance and commitment therapy is, of course, values and values-based living. Here are the questions. Are you living the life that you want to live right now? If the answer to that is no, for you or for your clients, then the answer is right now, put yourself where you want to be. If you're not happy, put yourself in the state of happiness. It's amazing. We actually have control over our own states. I can be happy even if I experience pain. That is something that my clients do not know. That has to be taught to them. Here's a question. Is your life focused on what's most meaningful to you? If not, what action can you take today to derive meaning? Shifting from uselessness to mental management to life engagement really is the process of values-based living. What's most important to you? It really is only our mental games that keep us from experiencing this now. Let me repeat that. It's our mental games, our relational frames, that keep us from experiencing this now. This is the belief that something must be resolved or happen before I can experience or make a change. Those are faulty mental premises. There are six core processes within acceptance and commitment therapy. And this lecture, of course, is not an exhaustive course on acceptance and commitment therapy. I could easily do probably a 12-part course just on each of these six core processes. But these six things are really a conceptualization of what the process of ACT therapy is all about. I'm convinced that many therapists go into therapy sessions without recognizing a beginning, a middle, and an end for therapy. And that when we conceptualize therapy as a temporal process, when I recognize that I'm not my client's best friend, but I'm really the paid temporary professional that's going to help them find a best friend, I can move into a belief set or an action strategy where there is a beginning and a middle and an end of therapy. And these six core processes really could be the beginning of a conceptualization for a complete therapeutic process. The first is acceptance. Clients often present trying to get rid of pain. I don't want to be anxious anymore. I don't want to be afraid to fly. I don't want to smoke anymore. I don't want to be obese. This is often how our clients present. Trying to get rid of pain, trying to forget the past, or they come in trying to change something that is unchangeable. And acceptance, again, acceptance is not about liking something, hoping that it happens to other people, wishing that it happens again, but simply recognizing its existence in our life. And like the quote from Alcoholics Anonymous says, acceptance is the answers to all of my problems today. The quote from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that's really so profound is, until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. The next process in ACT therapy is cognitive fusion. Our clients come to us because their previous strategies have failed. The previous strategies to problem solve have actually made things worse, and by paying attention to the pink elephant in the room or the yellow Jeep, they have become fused to their thoughts. They now believe what they think. And thoughts and facts are often two different things. And as a result, they're only aware of the pink elephant in the room or only aware of the yellow Jeep that they're trying not to think about. Being present is the next process in ACT therapy. And in my sessions is actually one of the first things I teach my clients. The reason why is I teach them that skill just like I taught you in the previous session, but it takes time for them to practice this to really understand what the value of it is. The fourth process in ACT therapy is self as context. This is really about using a strategy to help a person become their observant self. This is one of the reasons why we focus on the breath. It's to practice observation rather than enmeshment. See, my clients are just angry. They don't observe anger. My clients are just depressed. They feel it. It permeates them. They don't observe depression. If anyone's familiar with neurolinguistic programming, you may be familiar with first, second, and third perceptual position. The first position is me as me. But in dissociation, we can also move to a second perceptual position. This is where I would be an observer seeing me in a situation. Or even a third perceptual position, dissociated even further, where I'm an observer watching an observer watch me. And by taking our clients through processes where they really step out of themselves and observe themselves as if from above or from a new vantage point, they can really begin to practice seeing themselves in context of a situation rather than as the situation. Values are the fifth core process. This process is about choosing a direction and establishing willingness. Willingness is really a key word in ACT therapy. And in the next session, I'm going to share with you an exercise called the Willingness Dial that you can actually take your clients through to help them experience and identify willingness. And to identify motivating values and to establish willingness to help regain control of life, not necessarily just to control thoughts or feelings. Willingness is not resignation. It is also not the same thing as wanting. It is a willingness to experience, to accept, and to face negatively valued emotional states. The sixth core process in ACT therapy is committed action through practice. All of my clients are prepared each session to build on the learnings of the previous session so that when therapy concludes, they can continue to practice these things in a committed action towards a valued path that sees themselves in context of not just an internal experience, but as an outside observer, being mindfully present in that world directly, not fused or meshed with their emotions, and accepting that life is sometimes difficult. Notice I just went through those six core processes backwards. These six core processes can become the foundation for a structured program in ACT therapy, classes in ACT therapy, or can be modified based on our individual in different formats of therapy, hospitalization, partial hospitalization, outpatient therapy, counseling, coaching, strategic intervention to maximize the potential of our client. My goal in this course is not only to talk about therapy, but also to give you some very practical strategies for actually doing therapy. So in the time that we have remaining in today's session, I'm going to bring you through a simple process that I sometimes use with clients to help them identify core values. And again, I've provided an actual written script that you can utilize with your clients or adapt to be used with your clients. In our next lesson, I'm actually going to go through a number of different processes with you, because when you experience these things, you will understand the value and the application to the clients that you work with. And of course, a big part of ACT therapy is creating a value direction, developing a manner of living that's really congruent with those values. When one is congruent in choosing a value direction, then unwanted and distracting behavior is decreased. So, in the notes, I provided a script that you can use for identifying those core values, and I'm going to go through that script with you now. And so, if you're driving a car, you're certainly not going to want to close your eyes. In fact, you might want to fast forward not only through the rest of this session and the next session, coming back to them later, but you'll want to remain fully attentive to what it is you're doing. But if you're in a safe place, if you're not in a moving vehicle, you can just kick back in your chair. It's always nice to earn CEUs with the eyes closed. And so close your eyes, mindfully breathing in, paying attention to the breath in and out. And I do this with my clients all the time. I ask them to simply close their eyes. Why not? They enjoy closing the eyes, especially when a day has been stressful and they may have some of the emotional fatigue from the day. They don't go to sleep, especially since I'm asking them to actively use their mind. Instead, they simply relax into a resource state. And so with your eyes closed, imagine that you've just received a present. Imagine that present's a surprise. You don't even know who sent it, but you are now holding it. It won't be a simple gift, but rather a magical gift. The one thing that you want more than anything else in life. Maybe it's big, or perhaps small. Or maybe it's too big to actually hold. It's your present, so you can see it any way you want to. You can even hear the present. When a child is trying to figure out what's inside of a gift, they often shake it. You can do that in your own mind, hearing the gift inside of the box. Feel the shape of the box. Is it square, rectangle, or even an odd shape? Of course, this is your gift. I don't want to hold you back. So at this moment, you can begin to open the gift using that creative imagination, finding inside the wrapping exactly what you wanted more than anything else. Perhaps it's the deed to a vast and beautiful land, or a diamond worth millions of dollars, or even a winning lottery ticket. It's your gift. You can create it as you want it. So go large, taking this opportunity to discover what you would want more than anything if you were to receive a magical gift. Allow yourself to dream big, to open the present and enjoy that magnificent gift inside. Now, the papers that you opened, wrapping papers, are laying to the side. You're holding that unwrapped gift in your hand, or place the gift out in front of you and just breathe. See your gift. And imagine all the changes in life as a result of getting that gift. Now note, because you got that gift, how will life change? How will you feel? What experience will it bring? Perhaps a sense of freedom? Maybe respect from other people? Will you be able to help others now that you have received this gift? Will the gift help you to be more secure or even to be more important? Take a moment and explore this idea in your mind. The idea that you have this gift and some of your deepest needs can be met. What are those deepest needs? Become aware of them. Note the words that come into your mind that describe these needs. And notice the feeling that you associate with having imagined receiving this gift. Now open your eyes. Take in a breath. Open your eyes. Feel fantastic. And tell me, what words come to your mind right now? Pick two or three of those words. Now close your eyes again. Close them down, let yourself relax and breathe. Noting the feeling of the breath as you continue to take a moment and relax. It's interesting how what we truly value or need is often represented by an object or something tangible. In this case, the gift. What was actually inside of that box. But with a little reflection, you soon discovered what is most important is not the gift itself, but those words that you just said, what the gift represents. You described what you valued most as blank and blank. This exercise has helped you to identify your core values. This is your valued direction. And so as I spend the rest of the session with you, the rest of our time together, all of the suggestions I give you, which are actually suggestions that you've asked me to make by coming here today, will help you to move towards these valued directions. Now, go ahead, take in another breath, mindfully aware of that breath. Letting the oxygen reach every cell of the body, energizing the body, feeling fantastic, and opening the eyes, ready for the rest of the day. Now, this exercise, this script that I guided you through, is a great experiential activity to help your clients to identify their core values. Because I'm not actually speaking to you, since this is in a recording, I've, instead of filling in the blanks, simply used blanks. You will be with your client in the room. This will have to be adapted and tailored to them. The speed, the rate, what it is that you focus on, and how you follow up with it. But this is really a great exercise at helping clients use the resource states that are within them to identify those core values that can help them to identify a valued direction. When you have clients who are stuck in therapy, this is a great exercise. I've done this with couples where he and she, Bob and Bertha, are sitting next to each other, both with their eyes open, both coming up with different gifts, both coming up with different words, not even processing with them the exercise, but simply taking those to determine what our valued path in couples counseling is going to be. In our next lesson, I'm going to share with you again some specific exercises related to implementing strategies of ACT therapy that you will find helpful. Again, if you have not yet joined our forum, please do. www.changeworkforum.com. It's a great place to ask questions, to interact with other professionals, and to receive really any clarification if you have any questions.